Before we get into the specifics about the benefits of vitamin D, it would probably be helpful to talk about exactly what is vitamin D and where does it come from. Vitamin D is unique among all the vitamins because it's the only one that we can actually get from a non-food source. Vitamin D can be manufactured in the skin from exposure to sunlight. And there's a lot of confusion around that, which I will clear up as we go forward. But the other thing that's confusing about vitamin D is that it has so many different names. Vitamin D, when we manufacture it in the body, the natural human form of vitamin D, is called vitamin D3. And the scientific name for that is cholecalciferol. So cholecalciferol is the natural human form of vitamin D. Cholecalciferol converts to calcidiol in the liver. The other name for calcidiol is 25-OHD. And this is the circulating form of vitamin D that is in our bloodstream. It's our reservoir of vitamin D for all of the different uses that vitamin D or all of the different roles that it performs. Calcidiol, or 25-OHD, can be converted to a hormone, and then as a hormone, vitamin D is called calcitriol. And calcitriol can be formed by immune cells and by cells and tissues everywhere in the body. There are dietary sources of vitamin D also. We can get vitamin D from food, and some of the foods that provide vitamin D are fish, herring, salmon, sardines, and also fish oils. Cod liver oil is a source of vitamin D. Eggs provide some vitamin D, but only if the hens are supplemented with vitamin D. And there are also fortified foods. Milk can be fortified with vitamin D, and currently orange juice is being fortified with vitamin D. But important, in milk, there's typically only about 400 units in an entire quart, so we really can't get meaningful levels of vitamin D from the fortified foods. Dietary supplements are another way to get vitamin D, and that seems to be the most effective way to get vitamin D levels where we want them to be for best effect. But how do we obtain vitamin D? First of all, let me say that there is a distinction between vitamin D3 and vitamin D2. And so let me define that. Vitamin D3 is the form cholecalciferol that we can make from sunlight exposure. That's also the form that is in the foods that naturally yield vitamin D, so the herring or the cod liver oil. The fortified food products sometimes have vitamin D2, and the name of vitamin D2 is ergocalciferol. And some vitamin D supplements are ergocalciferol. That's really not the one that you want. Vitamin D3 has a longer half-life. It's more active in the body, 3 times more active than vitamin D2, and it's got twice the time of activity. Vitamin D3 has a half-life of 60 days, where vitamin D2 is only about 30 days. So how do we get vitamin D3? Well, sunlight exposure is certainly one way, and you'll read articles that say that if you're out in the sun for 20 minutes, you can make adequate levels of vitamin D. Responsible sun exposure is a way of making vitamin D3, but it's only going to happen under the right conditions. So there are a bunch of different caveats to whether or not sun is going to be a sufficient source for us of vitamin D3. So here are some of the conditions. It's the making of vitamin D3 is dependent on season and time of day. So in the winter, you're not going to make adequate vitamin D. And let's look at the USA. It's an issue of latitude. The 35th latitude, the 35th parallel, which in your mind's eye, draw a line from Phoenix to Atlanta. Above that, there's little or no vitamin D manufactured between October and March. So that period of time, we refer to that as the vitamin D winter. Now, there's a longer vitamin D winter if you live in Toronto. Obviously, it has to do with the angle of the earth and your proximity to the equator. So the season has to be right. The time of day also has to be right. It needs to be pretty much midday. And here's how you know if it's the right time of day. Look at your shadow. If your shadow is taller than you are, then you're not going to be able to make adequate vitamin D. And I'll say why in a moment, but judging by your shadow, if it's early in the morning, you have a longer shadow, or if it's later in the afternoon, then the concentration of ultraviolet rays needed to make the vitamin D, it's too weak. So the time of day is an issue. The other issue is, what color is your skin? Vitamin D is not politically correct. The darker your skin, the lower your ability to generate vitamin D from sunlight exposure. And if you're an African American with very dark skin, the reduction in vitamin D could be as much as 99% compared to someone that has much fairer skin. It's also reduced by age. A person at the age of 70 can only manufacture 25% of the vitamin D that they were able to make at age 20. And then another issue is sunscreen. And this is the big problem in our culture right now, with us having, the majority of people having, very low vitamin D levels. People are wearing sunscreen every time they go out the door. We've been cautioned to make sure that we have some kind of sun protection factor in place in order to prevent skin cancers. SPF 8, which is very mild as the sun protection factors go, reduces vitamin D production by 95%. So in order to make adequate vitamin D from sunlight, we have to have all of these things, all of these correct conditions in place. And since most people are wearing sunscreen and are avoiding the midday sun, it's probably going to be necessary for them to take vitamin D3 supplements in order to really raise their vitamin D levels. So specifically, how does the body produce the vitamin D3 from sunlight? The sunlight shines on your arm. In your arm, in the cells in your arm, there is a pre-vitamin D compound called 7-dehydrocholesterol. And ultraviolet B warms up the 7-dehydrocholesterol. It has to be a UV index of 3 or greater, hence the vitamin D winter conversation that we just had. And when that happens, the 7-dehydrocholesterol turns into cholecalciferol. It goes to the liver. The liver turns it into 25-OHD, or calcidiol. That 25-OHD circulates around in the body for about 60 days, and the other tissues, the breast, the colon, the prostate, the immune cells, the kidney, can turn the 25-OHD into the hormone calcitriol. And the hormone calcitriol is very short-acting. That's why we don't measure that. When we do a measurement of vitamin D status, we measure the 25-OHD. It's a long lifespan, so we can get an accurate look at your level. Calcitriol, it's a moment-to-moment level, so it really wouldn't be accurate. Now, how much is ideal? Let's say you listen to this, and today you decide, I need to get tested, and I think you will. You need to know, what kind of level are you shooting for? Because the averages are all too low. So even when we come back with lab values, a lot of times those lab values are not consistent with what we know about optimal vitamin D levels. So looking at the U.S., in the winter, we average 15 nanograms per milliliter. That's how we talk about vitamin D levels in the U.S. If we were in Canada or anywhere else in the world, we would be using nanomoles per liter. And the conversion is, for nanograms per milliliter, you multiply times 2.5, and that will give you the nanomole per liter number. So if you're living outside of the U.S. and you want to straighten this out, that's the way that you do that. Measure the nanogram per milliliter number that I'm talking about times 2.5. That'll be what your lab result looks like. But here in the U.S., winter levels average 15 nanograms per milliliter. In the summer, the average is 18 to 20. If you're a lifeguard, young, fair-complected, out in the sun, most of your body exposed for most of the day, the physiological level from sunlight exposure is 60 nanograms per milliliter. And if you are young and fair complected and not wearing sunscreen and all the conditions are right, you can actually generate between 10,000 and 25,000 units of vitamin D in about a half an hour of sunlight exposure, assuming that most of your body is exposed. So you're in a bikini, not a business suit. Now, the disease reduction bottom line is 32 nanograms per milliliter. So think back. We're not there. 15 in the winter, 18 to 20 in the summer. So there's an issue right there. Now, the ideal level, the proposed ideal level, and this is opinion of most of the vitamin D researchers in the world, and there's a pretty solid good couple handfuls of vitamin D researchers generating the incredible volume of research that we see every day in the news. The proposed ideal level is somewhere between 40 and 60 nanograms per milliliter. So the 60 nanogram, they're taking that from the lifeguard's physiological level. 40, they're taking that from some cancer studies. But suffice it to say that we are nowhere even close. So what would researchers say about ideal levels? This is what we're looking at as of right now, and it's 2009, less than 20 nanograms per milliliter is deficiency. So I just said that we're averaging 20 in the summer. What does that mean? That means we're not even getting out of deficiency in the summer when the sun is shining. So we can't have this idea that we don't need to take vitamin D in the summer. 21 to 30 nanograms per milliliter is considered insufficient. We need to be higher than that in order to get into ideal or acceptable range. And the acceptable range is 31 to 100 nanograms per milliliter. What about toxicity, you might be thinking? We don't believe that toxicity even has a chance to occur at anything less than 150 nanograms per milliliter. So that's roughly 10 times higher than what we average in the winter. And what would you need to take to get to toxicity? You would need to take 40,000 units a day for a period of 2 to 3 months. And no one is recommending doses that large. Now, what would you need to take to get to 40 nanograms per milliliter? On the average, here's the rule of thumb. We're knowing that you're getting some of it from your diet. You're probably taking a multivitamin. You might be taking a bone formula that has vitamin D. That's already pretty much in place in our population, and we're averaging deficiencies. So diet plus sunlight plus a supplement of vitamin D, 4,000 units a day, is the amount that, as a rule of thumb, would get the majority of people in North America to 40 nanograms per milliliter. And here's another rule of thumb. You get your level back and you want to increase it 10 nanograms per milliliter, whatever you have been taking, add 1,000 units of extra vitamin D3. If you need to raise it 20 nanograms per milliliter, add 2,000 units. So you see how that works. The final area that vitamin D impacts significantly is the immune system. We're dealing with the threat of pandemic influenza infection every year. This year, swine flu raises its head again. Just a few cases in Mexico, and then suddenly we've got thousands of cases in the U.S. As it is, in 2009, the virus, the H1N1 influenza virus, doesn't seem to be particularly deadly, but it could come back with a vengeance as the flu season emerges yet again next year. And so the researchers are scrambling to work out a vaccine for H1N1, but don't wait for that, because the strongest protection that's probably available for us is increasing our vitamin D serum levels, because vitamin D appears to be a pivotal immune system modulator. So let me explain how. Vitamin D as a hormone, calcitriol, induces the differentiation of different immune cells. And what differentiation means is how the cells actually mature and become the best expression of themselves. For example, white blood cells, they start out as stem cells, monocytes, and they have a very good capacity for something called phagocytosis. And all that means is that they circulate around in the bloodstream and they gobble up infectious material. They're antimicrobial. They look for bacteria, they look for viral cells, they look for funguses, and they consume them. The monocyte, as a macrophage, that's an adult monocyte, actually engulfs the infectious invader and then attacks it with cytotoxic enzyme activity and busts it apart, virus or bacteria. So a few things are related to vitamin D with that scenario. Those white blood cells are circulating around in the bloodstream, and we want them to be potent and powerful. We want them to be fully mature. That's the differentiation. That depends upon calcitriol, vitamin D. So the growing up of monocytes into macrophages is a vitamin D-linked process, and we've known it since the early 1980s. The vitamin D also increases the activity of those lysosomal enzymes that are inside the macrophages that do that cellular poisoning of bacteria and viruses, the cytotoxic activity. Those enzymes are much more poisonous to the virus and bacteria if we have higher vitamin D status. So there's another fundamental reaction. And then there is a compound that's produced in our lungs, in our throats, in our sinuses called cathelicidin. And cathelicidin is an antimicrobial peptide. It's a protein that also can kill bacteria, viruses, funguses, but it is particularly deadly against influenza, and it is particularly deadly against tuberculosis. And here it would help to back up a little bit. If we lived in Europe in the 1700s and we were exposed to or infected with tuberculosis, and we were wealthy, we might be sent south. If we lived in Finland or Norway, we might be sent to Italy in order to go and soak up the sun. And many people went to sunny areas and basked in the sunlight, and their TB seemed to be cured. Of course, in the 1600s and 1700s, they didn't know that what was happening was the body was producing vitamin D from the sunlight exposure, and the vitamin D was enhancing cathelicidin production, and cathelicidin was killing the tuberculosis bacterium. But we know that now, and we know that it works against influenza as well. So enhancing production of cathelicidin is another very strong benefit for immune response. Now, here's the thing that I find to be fascinating, and biochemistry to me, as you can tell, is fascinating. The immune cells actually produce the ability, the machinery, to manufacture their own vitamin D receptors. Immune cells can actually express vitamin D receptors, which are then switched on by the hormone form of vitamin D, ramping up the toxicity of those cytotoxic compounds, ramping up the production of cathelicidin. And the immune cell also produces the enzyme, the hydroxylase enzyme, that can turn the circulating 25-OHD into the calcitriol. So the immune cell on its own can produce the hormone calcitriol from circulating 25-OHD and can manufacture its own vitamin D receptor for that hormone to attach to ramp up the production of these antimicrobial toxic compounds that are basically defending us from infection. Again, evidence that vitamin D is absolutely fundamental to the normal functioning of immune system. So what are some examples in research? Well, there was an observation of vitamin D with seasonal immunity and influenza that happened at a California state prison. It's a psychiatric prison, Atascadero State Hospital in California. And one of the doctors there, John Cannell, is one of the most outspoken advocates of vitamin D. He is the head of the Vitamin D Council and has a very active website. If you want to go and Google that, you can find a lot of good information about vitamin D. He has his prisoners in his ward. He's a psychiatrist, and in this ward, in this prison, he has everyone on 2,000 units of vitamin D. So what happened was in 2005, a particularly virulent form of influenza came into the hospital, and people were dropping like flies, being infected, very sick. And the nurses work in all the different wards in this hospital, and the one area where people did not get sick was Dr. Cannell's ward. And so he immediately thought, well, I think it's that 2,000 units of vitamin D. So he contacted other researchers who in fact, said, yes, absolutely. Vitamin D status, we suspect, is the reason why influenza season happens in the winter, because vitamin D levels are so much lower during the winter months. And, you know, the influenza virus is present on the planet 12 months out of the year. So there's got to be a reason why in the northern hemisphere, when it's winter, we have influenza, and then it seems to move and go to the southern hemisphere. And we believe that the reason is the fluctuating levels of vitamin D associated with the colder weather and the lack of sun exposure and the reduced ultraviolet strength. Another study that really looked at rates of infection with vitamin D found something very interesting. This was the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. It's an ongoing study where people's nutrition status is analyzed and then correlations are made with different kinds of health events. And in this particular look at this study, they looked at children with respiratory infections, and they connected that with vitamin D status. And what they found was that children that had very low levels of vitamin D were actually 11 times more likely to be infected with some kind of respiratory infection compared to healthy children being defined by better vitamin D status and no infection rate. So lower vitamin D means that you are more at risk for different kinds of infections, respiratory infections. And another study showed that nowhere does that seem to be more evident than in people who have chronic respiratory diseases, asthma patients and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease patients are much more likely to have respiratory infections when they have a vitamin D deficiency. Now, vitamin D deficiency, the asthma and infection finding is not the only lung finding. Vitamin D deficiency is also associated with more severe asthmatic response in children and also more severe allergic response. So to sum up the relationship between infections and vitamin D, we have a stronger immune response when we have a better circulating level of 25-OHD, a better reserve to give to the immune cells so that they can produce calcitriol, so that they can produce stronger levels of the enzymes that kill bacteria, fungus and virus in the bloodstream, and also higher levels of cathelicidin. And in the research surveys, the lower the levels of vitamin D, the much, much greater the rate of respiratory infections. Don't wait for the right flu vaccine to be developed. Now is the time to get your vitamin D level measured and then take appropriate action to raise your D level to at least 30 nanograms per milliliter or higher. My suggestion, again, is 40 to 60 nanograms per milliliter. Another area where vitamin D seems to have a clear benefit is rates and risk of cancer, and the deadliest of cancers. The people that have been doing the most research in this area, they're all over the world, but the leaders of these studies are a pair of doctors, Cedric Garland and Frank Garland. Cedric Garland is usually the lead author in the cancer studies, and he's a cancer prevention specialist at the Moores Cancer Center at the University of California in San Diego. And here's one look that he took at cancer. He estimated that 250,000 cases of colorectal cancer and 350,000 cases of breast cancer could be prevented worldwide every year by increasing intake of vitamin D3, particularly in countries north of the equator. Vitamin D3 is available, obviously, through supplements, and it would require supplemental levels in meaningful doses to get to the level that they found that was protective. But they reported in the journal Nutrition Reviews that 600,000 cases of breast and colorectal cancer could be prevented every year worldwide, including 150,000 cases in the U.S. alone. And they looked at a dose-response relationship between vitamin D and cancer. The study combined information from surveys of serum vitamin D levels during the winter from 15 different countries, and it's the first study that actually also looked at satellite measurements of sunshine and cloud cover in countries where actual blood serum levels of vitamin D3 had been determined. And then they took that information and applied it to 177 different countries to estimate the average serum level of vitamin D and then look at cancer incidence. And this is what they found. They found an inverse association of serum vitamin D with risk of colon and breast cancer. And the protective effect for vitamin D began at levels ranging from 24 to 32 nanograms per milliliter of 25OHD in the serum. Obviously, that's the measurement of vitamin D status. Again, I want to point out that the late winter average of 25OHD here in the U.S. is 15 nanograms per milliliter. Now, there have been previous studies by Drs. Garland and colleagues and have been published in journals of steroid biochemistry and cancer journals. And what they found in previous studies was that raising the 25OHD levels to 55 nanograms per milliliter was optimal for cancer prevention. And this is why I've joined the group of people that say, try to get your levels between 40 and 60. 60 is the lifeguard physiological dose, but 55 seems to be, based on Garland and colleagues, and this is the leading research with vitamin D levels in cancer, 55 seems to be optimal for cancer prevention. So that would best be achieved with a combination of diet and supplements and short intervals, 10, 15 minutes a day in the sun. So that's really something interesting. Cancer is neck and neck with heart disease. And here we have information that could help us reduce the rates of both cancer and heart disease. Now, that's not the only meta-analysis that Garland and Garland have done. They also took a look at 63 different papers and examined vitamin D3 levels in populations and looked not just at breast and colon cancer, but also ovarian cancer and prostate cancers. And this study, which was published in 2007, found something very exciting. They said boosting levels of vitamin D3 by taking daily doses of 1,000 units in men or 1,500 units in women would decrease the risk of those cancers by 50%. Now think about that. What that means is that the level that you'd have to get to is low enough, and yet the reduction is strong enough that we could see half the incidence of new colon, breast, ovarian, and prostate cancers with doses that are literally pennies per day. 1,000 units in men, 1,500 units in women isn't even going to get you to the 40 nanograms per milliliter that I'm recommending. But in the United States, we have 750,000 new breast cancer patients diagnosed every single year. So theoretically, based on this observance, if we could reduce that by half, we would be saving billions of dollars. Never mind the suffering, and I don't say that in a heartless manner. Of course, care about the suffering. But if you're diagnosed with breast cancer in the United States as a woman, you're going to spend between $50,000 and $100,000 to treat that. Reduce that, on the average, $75,000 by 350,000 people on an annual basis, and we are talking about billions of dollars per year in reduction in healthcare costs. Now, what's the comparison in reducing rates of cancer with our leading approach? The leading approach is mammography. It doesn't actually do anything to prevent. It's early detection. Early detection with mammography only reduces the mortality rate by 20%. So for me, for my money, I would rather reduce incidence by half. And that's why I think that the cancer studies are becoming more and more exciting. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. The products mentioned are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hi, my name is Jolie Root, and I'm a health educator. I'm a nutrition counselor and a nurse. My nutrition career dates back to the early 1980s. I decided to record this CD on the benefits of vitamin D because in my entire career, few single nutrients have shown so much promise. The purpose of this recording is to spotlight the many health benefits of vitamin D and the role of vitamin D deficiency in increasing the risk of many common and serious diseases, including some common cancers, type 1 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and osteoporosis. To say that vitamin D is very important to our health is an understatement. It's protective against a number of our deadliest diseases. Low levels of vitamin D double our risk of not just heart attack and stroke, but also several of the deadliest cancers. Vitamin D is a vitamin that everyone who is interested in their own health and longevity should be taking.